So this panel is called Anarchy on the Shop Floor, Anarchists Organizing in Contemporary Labor Struggles. My name's Doug. I live here in Oakland. I work for AC Transit, member of ATU Local 192. So I wanted to put this panel together to talk about what anarchists are doing in their workplaces. How are they resisting? Anarchism means a lot of things. It's a way to look at the world, critique it, an idea about what life might be like without capitalism in the state, but it's also about fighting. It's also about how do we relate to people in struggle. And one of the things that we do most is we go to work. We get up, we sell our labor power to survive in this system. So the question of how do you struggle at work is a key question. And with May Day right around the corner, May Day being a holiday inspired by anarchist resistance, people organizing, you know, I thought it would be great to have these people out here today to talk. So first up, we have Lauren. I'll let Lauren introduce herself, but Lauren's going to be talking about organizing that happened with the Port of Oakland Truckers Association. It was a self-organized group of independent truckers right here in the Port of Oakland. We also have Robbie. Robbie's going to talk about a group that he's involved with called United Rank and File. It's a self-organized group of construction workers right here in the Bay Area. Then we have Mikey. Mikey was involved with organizing drive by industrial workers of the world at Whole Foods locally. We also have Cole. Cole's been involved in a lot of stuff. He was involved in unionizing campaign with IWW at Starbucks and also at his workplace in, what was the town?
Turlock.
In where?
PG&E Grand Rapids, back home.
Right. And now he's a IWW worker, he's an electrician. So let's go ahead and get started. We had a series of questions, which everybody feel comfortable with the questions, or do you need me to repeat them? Okay, everybody's. But basically, the questions are: is this, and we're going to try to shoot for about 10 minutes each with each person, and then we'll go into Q&A, and hopefully we'll have 20 minutes, and hopefully the people that come after us don't show up, and we'll be able to continue the conversation. But the questions were basically as follows: like, just tell us about the struggle that was happening at your workplace, what worked, what didn't, what were the divisions that you had to overcome at your workplace, whether it was based around patriarchy, whether it was racism, language barriers, people from different nationalities, and also what were the barriers that you had to overcome as far as if you were at a workplace where there was a union, the union bureaucracy and the union apparatus, how did you overcome that to organize your workplace? So we're going to start with Lauren, and we'll just go down the line.
Okay, so first of all, the poor trucker struggle is a little bit different, like for so many reasons. It was really, really complex, and it would be impossible for me to really, truly answer those questions in 10 minutes. So I'm going to try and stick with the spirit of the idea. But like I said, it's so complicated. I could probably spend an hour just talking about the racial dynamics within the group of the poor truckers themselves. But so I made a list of really important things to talk about, and I just want to talk, just say really quickly what they are so that people understand a little bit more about how complex it is before I try and get with the spirit of the questions. I think I could have spent a lot of time talking about each of these things individually. The politics within the port truckers grouping, people wanting to be in a union, some people wanting to not be in a union, some people wanting to be a part of a chamber of commerce, some people wanting to be employees, some people wanting to never, ever, ever be employees, some wanting to start their own trucking company. What happened, the details of what went down, what the conditions were that the truckers were working in and still are working in, just like a mile that way, less than a mile. The interaction between us, the like political sort of like rabble rousers, and the truckers themselves, and also with our interactions with the ILWU, the relationship between truckers and the ILWU on the port, the relationship between us and the ILWU in general, the history of Teamsters trying to organize at the port. There's a really tender spot there for the truckers. The Teamsters, they really feel like did them dirty. And so following out of that, why Long Beach can't happen here, why the type of organizing that's happening in Long Beach is really just impossible here because those relationships are, they're decimated. There's no trust there. The organizing that happened at the port with different groups before the truckers really sort of started popping off, different socialist groups organizing and flyering at the port, why that wasn't successful, and why it wasn't really helpful to the truckers in their organizing, how interventionist comrades tried to intervene in the struggle as we were working on it before, during, and after, and currently, and how we got good media. How we got such good press, and I would just say really quickly that the way that we got such good press is that somebody who worked on labor struggles in media before mentored me, and through the process of doing the media work for the port truckers, I mentored someone else and watched them get really, really good coverage for a struggle going on in Oakland around housing. And so I would just say really quickly that skill sharing is something that we really have to incorporate into all of our organizing all the time, so that we so that we can move forward and spread what we learn to other struggles. Okay, so those are some of the most important things that could never be covered in a 10-minute talk. So just really briefly, the port truckers were a self-organized group. When I came up on them, they had already had some like major actions down at the port where they were cutting lines on people's chassis, where they were breaking windows. But nobody knew about it. Nobody had any idea what was going on down there. There might be a news coverage saying, oh, some boxes didn't make it out of the port today. The truckers are acting up. But nobody knew like the extent of what they were experiencing and the extent of which they were to which they were resisting. And that was one of the interventions that I think was really positive on our part, was to bring attention to what was going on for them. I don't think there are many people in the Bay Area now who don't know that the conditions that truckers work in are really heinous. And the way that I got involved was that I came up on their meeting, and I just want to describe it because I think of it as like one of the sort of pinnacle moments of my life in political work. I was at this like kind of bogus picket line at the port around the BART strike, and there was a lot of arguing going on between the different unions, and then there was this group of like dirty guys on a hill, like 500 of them, and they had been working all day and they kind of looked like shit, and there were cops listening to their meeting, there were bosses listening to their meeting, and they were like almost oblivious to the level of surveillance that they were under and the level of repression that was around them, and they let me watch their meeting, which was kind of the first sign that like maybe the security culture was really, really terrible, because I just walked up and asked if I could watch, and they said sure. But in that meeting, they talked about the conditions that they were in with such a passion. And then they said, what are we going to do about it? And a crowd of 500 immigrants, none like probably seven languages spoken, none of them had the first language was English, except for one guy. And they started chanting, strike, 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 strike on the hill. And I like wanted to cry. I thought, this is it. This is where I'm going to be. This is what I want to do. And I did for as long as it lasted, as long as it was kind of on fire. One of the things that made our interaction with the port truckers organizing really different from other things is that we worked really hard to, good luck, we worked really hard to not intervene and not direct what they were doing, but to support what they were doing without a lot of direction. And I think there's a really big question about, was that successful and was it a good idea and how did we make it work? It sure felt really, really principled at the time. And there were some major successes with that style of organizing, of supporting what they wanted to do. And there were some failures because at the end, there was a huge rift between them and the ILWU. The politics started shifting rightward. And at that point, the relationship was established that we didn't intervene. And so there was really no place for us to like bring things back as they went off the rails. But that said, I don't regret not intervening. I think I would have a lot more what ifs if we had tried to boss them around and tell them how to do a worker struggle. But some of the successes that were really led by the truckers were there were times when we picketed on the port where it became really clear that the police were the ones that were enforcing the rules of the port, and the police were the ones enforcing the oppression of the bosses, and they became really acutely aware of the relationship between them and the police, maybe for the first time. And they would do these flying pickets where the truckers would be like, no, you know what? We're not going to let these cops pin us in here. And just a handful of them would start to go out around the cops. And we were able to literally physically follow them. And it was this sort of visual representation of what we were trying to do, which was to always let them lead and always have their back. And these flying pickets were incredibly successful that day, and we just kind of danced around the port, and we were all really exhausted when we came home, but it felt so good because we had made a huge impact that day, and the media coverage was, like, really incredible. People were really inspired by what was happening. And another huge success that happened that was trucker-led was a noise demo that happened at City Hall, and it was listed as a press conference, and so a lot of comrades just like didn't think it was important. They didn't want to engage the media, and they kind of had this like, well, the media is the enemy, and like we're not gonna have some big showy press conference. But they had no idea what was planned. So we were missing a lot of comrades. We had to make so much noise with our pots and pans to make up for the lack of comrades. But the truckers showed up in full force, and people from around town didn't know what was going on, but they could hear it because the block of City Hall was surrounded by semis honking their horns. And you really got a sense of how much power was there with those giant trucks, the spirit of the people engaged in the struggle, and how bad the air quality is when a whole bunch of trucks get together and idle, which is what was happening at the port. One of their complaints was that they were sitting idling for so long, burning gas while they waited for work. And some really incredible things that happened there with regards to the worker struggle with the police is that one of the truckers got pulled over by the police, and they said, well, we're going to cite you for using your horn illegally. And he said, well, if you're going to cite me, I'm going to use my horn anyway. And he starts honking it. And they go, okay, well, now we're going to arrest you for using your horn. And he said, well, if you're going to arrest me anyway, I'm just going to keep using my horn. And that was one of those times where the truckers led something, you know, he pulled over and started honking his horn, and all he did was put a call over the trucker radio that he was going to be arrested for honking his horn. And within a minute, his truck was swarmed by other trucks, by comrades, by people walking down the street trying to figure out what was going on, and everybody was screaming and shouting to have him let go. And ultimately, the police didn't have the power to keep him. And that was another time that where we were really successful in having the truckers' backs when they went out on a limb. So those were some of the successes, and those were some of the things that I would highlight. But I would also call attention to the fact that, you know, our supportive nature did not ultimately lead to major success for the truckers. And in the end, the politics did shift rightward. And then as far as, like, the interaction between, like, comrades and other workers... Hang on one second, sorry. Some of the things that we dealt with were that I think there was lots of backstabbiness between the truckers, and to explain it would be really difficult for me, and I'm just trying to rush through some of what I think are the most important things. But the racial breakup in the truckers group is really different than other workplaces. First of all, it's 100% immigrants. Maybe like 99.9% immigrants. I met two people born in the U.S. that are truckers. And they're all coming from different countries, and they're all speaking different languages, and they're all breaking off into racial and ethnic groups. And so there's division about strategies, tactics, politics within those groups. There's frustrations about who's more powerful and who's less powerful, and it breaks down exactly like you think it would. The darker your skin, the more people don't respect you and value you, and value your opinion, the more you're shut out of organizing. We definitely saw that. But the thing that was actually the hardest for us to work with, because there weren't a lot of ways we could intervene there, except for to say, what if we just have a sit down? What if we just, could we just have a conversation and mediate it? And that was successful a lot of the time. Sometimes in the biggest ways, it just wasn't. And there wasn't a lot that we could do to intervene, especially with our principle of not being intervening. We were like just doing damage control the best that we could sometimes in these disputes. But what we experienced was that there were communist groups that came in. First they come with their newspapers, then they come and they try and sneak into your meetings. And these are like closed meetings with truckers where we're trying to foster some security culture where they're learning how surveilled they are by the Department of Homeland Security, how surveilled they are by the cops, by the bosses. They had hired private investigators to follow the truckers around. I don't know if people know that, but they had hired private investigators to follow truckers from their homes to their work to their private lives. So these guys were sometimes terrified, like walking around with hoods over their heads, like trying to hide their faces. And so we tried to make private spaces for them, and those were frequently infiltrated by other people, like sort of acting as comrades, but really working in their own interests. And against the interests of the truckers, in the sense that they were actively trying to take the struggle and take their autonomy. Thank you. And then we had comrades who were anarchists who we had even previously worked with. Try to like sneak off to the side and develop personal relationships with individual truckers that they saw as being powerful and easy to interact with. These were like, you know, like English as a first language speaking truckers, and there were only two of them. And trying to develop these like personal social relationships so that they could access private information that was happening with the truckers and in these like manipulative ways intervene. And then we also experienced that when it was over, people tried to sort of take the narrative of the struggle and apply it to whatever it was that they wanted to do politically. And so these stories started being like mistold and misinterpreted, and information that had been gained in these like really kind of gross manipulative ways was being used to set up like talks about truckers where people who were really working on the struggle were never being consulted or talked to. And worse, the truckers themselves are so available. These are people who live in Oakland, Castro Valley, Fremont, Union City, San Pablo, Vallejo. These are people who are really close by, and no one ever invited them to talk about what they were doing. And, you know, let alone the people who were working directly with them. And so we saw that like people would bring up people organizing in Long Beach to talk about what had happened here, when not only had they not been here when it was happening, they had not been in contact with anyone who was doing the work, and they still weren't. And so they were misrepresenting what was happening here and pushing their political narrative from Long Beach and trying to connect the two, when the conditions may be similar, the workplaces may be similar, but the actual politics and the actual story of what's happening is incredibly different, and I don't think that they can just be conflated. So I think if I keep going, I'm gonna come up with something else to talk about for 10 minutes, so I should probably stop. But I would just say that for people who are really interested in what went down at the port, we were so heavily surveilled. There's a lot I can just be really open about, because like I'm pretty sure the government knows everything, every private email. So I'm happy to make myself available to like sit down and break bread and talk about what happened, because I think it's really, really important, especially going forward. And I don't think that anything can really happen at the port without a complex understanding of how it really works down there. And we really centralize the ILWU down at the port, and because we see them as having so much power. And I think that they do have a lot of power at the port, sure. And they have joined in with radical struggles quite a few times, and that's really great. But I think centralizing them is a huge mistake. And I think that it runs the risk of sort of like moving to this like unionist place instead of considering the conditions of workers themselves, you know, as like workers rather than union workers.
I'm talking today about United Rank and File. I also helped with the port truckers organizing, and so I might compare them a little bit as I talk, because I don't know what I'm going to say because I haven't prepared. But basically, the United Rank and File organizing stemmed from... Okay. So the United Rank and File organizing really stemmed from, I'm in a union, the IBEW Local 6, it's the Electricians Union in San Francisco. And San Francisco has historically had mostly most of the construction work is controlled by the unions, and so it's a new development after the economic collapse of 2008, where construction all but stopped in San Francisco, and we were all out of work, both union and non-union workers alike. And as things have picked up, and right now there's 27 cranes as we talk in San Francisco building various buildings. So there's a lot of construction work in San Francisco. But as it came back, the non-union sector came back more quickly than in the union sector. And so we're seeing this shift in dynamics that we've never seen before, where all of a sudden non-union companies are doing very, very large projects in San Francisco. And so the impetus for United Rank and File was when a company called Helix Electric, which is like one of the top 10 electrical contractors in the country, and has a long history where they started as a union contractor, and then there was a strike that was unsuccessful, and Helix broke away from the unions and became one of the largest non-union electrical contractors. So it's actually a really interesting history between them and Rexmore and some other companies that and they formed the Western Electrical Contractors Association, where the unions negotiate with the National Electrical Contractors Association. So it's almost the same type of association. And they started their own apprenticeship program. So they basically cut out everything that the workers have invested in the unions and set up almost the exact same system, just absent a union. And their model has been really successful, where they pay... There's a few people who really, really know the trade. They really do. They know it inside and out. And you'll talk to some of the standard moderate unionist folks, and they'll tell you, you know, the unions are better, quality, da, 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 da. That's not necessarily true. There's some electricians that work for these companies that are outstanding electricians, and they pay them way more than you would make as a union electrician. And so the unions can't simply go over and try and find the most qualified people and organize them into the union, because they would be against their best interests to do so, because they would be taking a pay cut to join the union. And then there's a whole lot of people that they never teach anything except for, you know, take this from here to here, put this here and here, and then they pay those people almost nothing. So it vastly makes up the difference between the union scale and the non-union scale. They also don't have to deal with the conditions, so they end up being able to bid jobs at a much lower price. And Helix Electric was able to land a contract with the city of San Francisco to rebuild the War Memorial Opera House, or the War Memorial Performing Arts Center. Sometimes I get them mixed up because they are almost the same place. But it's like $1 million electrical contract, and it's a huge job. And our union, Local 6, basically had to do something, right? Because the members were like, this is insane. It's behind City Hall. It's downtown. It's a huge electrical, you know, contract. Like, how can we let them come and do work, you know, in our backyard? Because San Francisco isn't used to that. So the union leadership felt like they had to do something, right? Otherwise, the membership might do something on their own, and that would be bad. So the union leadership set up a day to go down to City Hall. They inflated the big rat, and they had their rally, and then they went out. And this is the interesting part, was that then they went out and they walked sort of a picket line looking thing around the intersection of Van Ness and McAllister, right behind City Hall. And it was during rush hour in the afternoon, and they shut down Van Ness for about an hour, and it created chaos behind City Hall. And this was all done like through the union legitimate. And the things that my sisters and brothers in the union were saying would make any one of us blush about what we should be doing, right? And that got me excited, of course. And so the odd thing was that people didn't want to leave. They wanted to do something else. They wanted to go further. They wanted to go harder than what they were doing by just blocking this intersection, which to the union leadership was like a huge step, right? That was, for them, that was, that's not even legal. So they thought that they were going pretty far. But a few of the business reps came up and were like, what should we do now? And I'm like, you don't like me. Like, why are you talking to me now? All of a sudden, you want to know what my opinion is. And at the time, I was out on bail and facing some charges on another case. And so I didn't feel equipped to try and push too hard at the time. The police had already kind of identified me even that day in the midst of all these construction workers, where I thought I blended in pretty well. They came up and had a chat with me. So I didn't feel like it was my place. But what I did feel like I could do was talk to the people who I had heard, you know, making these statements about what they would like to do, and talk about, like, the possibility of doing that, kind of doing more organizing separately from the union leadership. And so we played this sort of dance for a little while with the union leadership, where we said, you know, we want to get all these rank and file workers from cross unions together, because everybody's facing this same sort of influx of suddenly risking the union's control over construction in San Francisco. And they thought that was a great idea, and they supported it. And we had two or three meetings at our union hall, and they were sending people from their unions. We had at one of our meetings, our most well-attended meeting, there was over 100 people. There were probably 30%, I would say, were bureaucrats or sent by the leadership. So I'm not going to try and say it was better than it was. And there was 8 different trades represented, and it was really amazing. And so we established ourselves as a group, as United Rank and File, and we voted to take an action on May Day, where we would try and shut down a job that was a 2-gate job. And the 2-gate system very quickly is a way that they've interpreted Taft-Hartley's secondary boycott law, where they you're only allowed to picket legitimately as a union. Legally, you're allowed to picket only the company with which you have a bone to pick, whatever. And so you even have to have signs that say, we specifically are picketing this company only, and we have a dispute with this company, nobody else. Like, that's the only way to be legal about it. So what they do at construction sites is they'll set up a gate right there, and they'll set up a gate right there, and they'll say, okay, Helix Electric can only come in this gate, everybody else goes in this gate. And now, to legally picket, the union can only picket that gate, because that's Helix Electric. That gate is not. And so if the union was to set up a picket in front of this gate right here, most of the people that work for Helix are going to be like, eh, I don't care. Like, it's just not, you know, it's not their thing. So you'd have to be a really aggressive picket, in which case most of the union leadership is not going to support a hard picket like that. So they can't set up a picket over here, where a lot of the union trades would be like, okay, solidarity and all that, I'm not going to go to work. So effectively, it makes it so that you can't shut down a construction site legally that has both union and non-union workers on it, just to say what that is. And so that really affects, that really hits, strikes a chord with a lot of the people in the IBEW and other unions, because it's made it so that, you know, they don't, people don't like to really see outside of the structure of what you are, you know, what's okay, what's an okay resistance, what's a legitimate and legal resistance. It even says in most union bylaws, we'll do all that we can by legal means, you know, which is totally ahistoric and sad that it's in everybody's constitution and bylaws. But what we did was we, at the May Day action, we were asked not to meet at that union hall anymore. And so we started meeting at the Redstone building, and probably we had less than half of what was at the last meeting when we voted. Even though we voted overwhelmingly to do this action on May Day, it still dwindled our actual organizing group by a lot. And so we basically at that point severed completely from union officialdom. And we organized for the May Day action, and we were able to picket that morning. This was 2 years ago now, May Day. And we fairly successfully shut down the job. You know, I'd say maybe 15% of the people went to work, but the job was pretty well. And one of the interesting things was that a lot of the non-union workers didn't go to work and came up to us and were really interested in hearing more about the union, how they might get in, which shows the lack of actual organizing that the unions are doing. But what I really wanted to just get to touch on really quickly was the overlap between the port trucker stuff and this, and that's in the organizing style. This was a little different for me because I had recently been like fairly publicly arrested for a political action, and so people knew my politics. It wasn't like the port truckers where we came completely blank, you know, they didn't know us, and took a while in personal building relationships and talking about politics for them to understand where we were coming from. People already knew kind of where I was coming from. So I didn't have to hide it, but I also was very much did not want to like push that on the group. I wanted to just take, you know, help support and foster this feeling that they wanted to resist what was happening and see how far we could push that. And in the end, I also have this now, this there's this dilemma, right? And it's I think something that we all need to think about in labor organizing, is that somehow we have to figure out how not to hide our politics and how to push it and how to foster what's happening without trying to talk at people, but struggle with people, and at the same time not give up those values and not let those things go by the wayside. Because a lot of times what ended up happening with the United Rank and File is that a couple of the comrades had other stuff to do, you know, I had other stuff going on, and so I took a break, and everybody took kind of a lot of the more radical folks in the group took a break. And next thing I know, United Rank and File was seen promoting an event which John Avalos for supervisor was at. And, you know, all these sort of, one section of it went sort of really liberal. And then I saw something posted. There was a member of the Spartacist League in our group. And I won't, I don't want people to roll their eyes too hard when I say that, because he did a lot of good work in that group. But I also saw stuff being posted under United Rank and File's name that was coming from the Workers' Vanguard. And I saw things happening all over. Like there was no political tie that bound. Just like with the port truckers, there was no real political tie that bound the group. And so it was all based on a common need to escape some sort of oppression, which I think is a good starting point. But how do we get from there and not just let it go completely all different directions when the struggle starts to die down?
Cool, thank you for that. All right, I'm gonna start my timer here. You got me? All right, yeah, just make yourself visible. I want Cole to get his in too. My name's Mikey. I live in the Bay Area, been living here for several years. I was involved in a briefly prominent organizing campaign at Whole Foods. And real quick, can y'all hear me all right in the back? No? Just right up in there. Okay, is that better? Right on. So I'll kind of give you kind of a broad stroke outline of what went down and just kind of summarize a few key lessons. I'm sure there will be some questions. We'll have some time to talk about that too, which will be good. So basically, I moved out here in 2009, and I came with some organizing experience already under my belt, but I also had a desire to expand my horizons politically. And I had a name to overcome the limitations of the organizing forms and methods that I had become familiar with in the IWW. Fast forward a couple of years. In 2011, I met a fellow Wobbly at a picket line in San Francisco. We were supporting some maritime workers who'd been retaliated against for their sexuality. But I learned from my new acquaintance that he'd been working at Whole Foods for some time, and that he had a small group of coworkers who were meeting regularly and wanted to somehow unionize Whole Foods, whatever that meant, which was very vague at the time. So, also a tall order. So we exchanged contacts and started to meet with them, and we developed a pretty good rapport fairly quickly. So at the time, it seemed like there was some potential, but I had no idea that it would later on be something that attracted national media attention, which it did. So basically, I used my experience and started mentoring some of the key people in the committee on the basics of organizing. A lot of that's just kind of nuts and bolts stuff like that any union will train you on. But we wanted to do something a little bit different, a little more, a little less disingenuous, and a little more human. So we started. We started talking about concepts of what this means in our lives and how we relate to these struggles long term, and not just treat these as kind of like flash in the pan, exciting things that might get you or your group's name in like the radical press or something. So we did that, and we started focusing on we kind of made like a long-term commitment and kind of saw this as a slow burn process, because we'd seen a lot of campaigns just kind of blow up and then fizzle out very quickly, there was little foundation laid to build a struggle, to win some gains, to defend those gains, and to inspire other workers to take on that struggle as their own, and possibly even organize in the future should they move on, which is really important to us. So So let's see. Yeah, we had a few small victories, which were really compelling for us and encouraging. So this was a store of about 200 folks working there, management included. And even with a small group, if it was starting around like four or five people, we were able to organize pretty wide sections of the store, not necessarily under the guise of a union, but approaching people about their shared experience and something that was pissing them off, something that we could relate to because we were workers there too. And to give you a couple of examples, there were a couple of people who were arbitrarily forced out, which is very common. A lot of y'all who have had the unfortunate experience of working in retail or food will know this all too well, but there's a revolving door in a lot of these places that's kind of intentional. And it's partly to keep wages down, to save money on paying benefits if they exist. But also, which is key, it's kind of a social control mechanism to keep like leaders from developing, which is something that we saw at Whole Foods. So there were a couple of people who kind of fit that bill, and we were able to mobilize kind of small-scale confrontations, petitions and stuff like that, and actually applied the right kind of pressure to the right people to get their jobs back. And so we use these as openings to approach other people to talk to them about what happened and kind of agitate. And by agitate, I don't mean the system's fucked up, right? It's really a process of asking questions and building a relationship, and it's kind of like a real life, like human workers inquiry, where you're trying to actually get to know like what people really care about, what moves them, and really who they are. So this is about the time that Occupy was popping off, and that was a pretty key part of the picture in those days when we were really in that building stage. And I think that's important to keep in mind is you know, your kind of localized struggle is largely influenced by what's going on in the backdrop, and in that case it was Occupy. And it kind of brought to the fore some of these questions like class and stuff like that that gave us a pretty wide opening to bring that stuff up in real terms. So around this time also we started doing within our committee like trainings. We'd taken some of the training programs that were available in the IWW and kind of adapting them. So that we could kind of train ourselves and push each other and adapt it so that when new people came in, we could kind of keep that tradition going. And one of the central goals was to reproduce the organizer is how we termed it. So we wanted really everyone who was involved to own what was going on and to see themselves as an agent of change and as a leader. And we were able to do that in a lot of ways. So a couple of key inspirations for us in shaping how we wanted the campaign to look and kind of creating a trajectory were two key things, which was the 34 trucker strike in Minneapolis. And there's a book about that I highly recommend to everyone here called Teamster Rebellion. And the autonomous movement in Italy in the 60s and 70s. And I don't want to go into those too much, but basically what was interesting to us was that everyday workers were able to organize kind of wide sections of the class with while reconciling their political orientation too. So like they were talking about, and I think they termed it like not intervening. I guess our intervention was maybe a non-interventionist intervention, if you want to call it that. But basically, we wanted to expand our coworkers' horizon of what was possible. We wanted to foster a revolutionary consciousness through conversation and relationship building, but also equally as much through confrontation with the bosses, because that's really where those things become clear. They become crystallized, and we recognize that. But we also didn't want to force anything down anyone's throats, because we all know that doesn't work. So those are a couple of just basic reasons why that inspired us, and that was pretty central to the campaign moving forward. So eventually I was working somewhere else and I needed extra income, and I ended up getting a part-time job there, switched to full-time, and I became the first SALT. So there were a few SALTs who came in to help the campaign, and SALT means someone who gets a job strategically to help an organizing campaign out, basically. So, so what else? What else happened, Cole?
2 minutes.
2 minutes, all right, cool. So, I mean, that's kind of like the story at the beginning. We did a lot of like in-depth relationship building, built a lot of trust, and used these smaller actions to kind of bolster ourselves to take on bigger things. We want more stuff on a local scale at the store, and we most of the time during the campaign we kind of saw ourselves as remaining underground. It wasn't very important for us to be flashy, to be known, but there came a point where we saw that there was only so far we could go while being underground. If we wanted to keep going, we had to come out in the open, because that way we would be more protected if we did. Otherwise, they were just going to start picking us off one by one, or even wholesale. So there was some advantages to coming out in the open. We decided to do that in November of last year. We had a delegation of about 20 workers at the store and a bunch of supporters. We delivered demands for $5 an hour across the board raise and no retaliation. Very simple. And just a quick note on the demand and the messaging. That was also a conversation we had ongoing with ourselves and our coworkers about what the demands would look like, what the messaging would look like. And we wanted to do our best to avoid kind of succumbing to the pressure to frame our demands in kind of like a liberal or like strictly reformist way. We wanted to obviously make some immediate reforms while opening the door for talk about the nature of the wage itself and basically revolutionary politics. Obviously, Wobblies and revolutionaries don't see, we don't consider any wage good. The relationship is one that's inherently unfair and exploitative, and we wanted that message to be out there and people to think about that. Cool. So I'm going to just summarize quickly the lessons. I might go over about 30 seconds. I hope that's okay, but I think it'll be worth it. My timer's going off. Everybody's yelling at me to shut up. So just really quickly, I think this is a good place to start is maybe with people who are politicized before they find themselves in a workplace organizing. There's a tendency, and maybe this is beyond workplace organizing too. But we're often looking for silver bullets. Like, what's the model that we can kind of replicate that's gonna be the silver bullet that's gonna give us the win, and revolution will be like around the corner. There are none, and that kind of sounds obvious, but it's really worth thinking about. I think there's a tendency to fetishize forms and tactics that have worked in a different place in a different time, and many lessons can be taken from that, but there's no one model. It's really gonna be determined like with the truckers and with this, by the conditions, by the consciousness of the workers involved, what they're willing to do and what they're willing to invest in, and stuff like that. You got to be flexible and you got to be realistic. With that comes with a lot of patience. So usually things don't go exactly as planned. Organizing strategies and drives have to be very flexible, and it's really a time commitment. You have to invest a lot of yourself if you want to be successful and if you don't want to come across as disingenuous. Two more quick points is, I will say humility, a little bit of that goes a long way. Revolutionaries have just as much to learn from their coworkers as they have to share. And that's a two-way relationship that you're building, and that's very important to keep in mind. So lastly is a little bit more on a personal note. And I think this was really important for me, and I think still is. The more I think about the Whole Foods campaign and the more I talk to other organizers is know yourself. Don't let your politics and your status as an organizer kind of cloud who you are. And even though politics and organizing are very important, and that's for two reasons. One is just basically when the campaign is over, who are you then? And also, your coworkers usually want to engage with people on more than just the organizing level. You're building relationships of trust. Those are based on all kinds of things that aren't necessarily quote-unquote political, although the politics you'll have to find are inherent in those things. So your job as a revolutionary is to draw those things out and see how far you can facilitate the expansion of consciousness of your coworkers. But it's got to come across that you care and you give a shit. And if you don't, that will come across. So, there's a whole lot more to say, obviously, but I got to cut it short and let Cole get his piece in. I appreciate y'all's time. I look forward to a little more discussion.
Thank you. My name is Cole Dorsey. Like Doug said, I'm from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I've been in the Bay for about 2 years now. And I've been trained, organizer trained in through the IWW, Organizer Training Program. I've given some trainings. I've been to about a dozen organized trainings around the country. So that's where I've learned the skills that I have used organizing on the job. My first foray into organizing was at Starbucks in 2006 is when I got hired there. For those that don't know, the Starbucks campaign started in 2004 in New York City with a store that went public there, public with the IWW, with a demand letter, all that. Shortly after that, it went to Chicago and then Massachusetts after that. I got a job early in 2006 at a Starbucks in Grand Rapids. So I'll just jump right into some of the successes and some of the lessons that were learned through the experience that I was there. The most important thing that I've learned, and it crosses all industries as far as organizing is concerned, a little bit what Mikey touched on, was the building relationships. The most important part is being being an exemplary worker. So they can't use, the boss can't later say, well, you know, they're just that lazy bum that wants a union because they don't want to work that hard. But that's not the truth. We want compensation for the work that we do. That's the point. So over and above anything, before any kind of actual organizing was going on at the Starbucks, I did above and beyond what I could to show to my coworkers that I was a hard worker and that I'll do whatever it takes to make everybody's job easier. And I think that's important no matter where you work, is to lead by example, in that we're not trying to be lazy or shiftless or things like that, but rather we're trying to get what we deserve, which is more compensation for the work that we do, what we produce. After that, like I said, I followed specifically the IWW model of organizing, which begins with doing one-on-ones after social mapping, determining what kind of demographic you have in the store or whatever location you're organizing. And soon after that, there was partner bonding nights that I set up, whereas just nothing union related was discussed or organizing necessarily, but typically if you get coworkers together in the same place in the social setting, you'll bitch about work or talk about work, you know? So that's good in respect to agitation. We use a model AEIOU, which is agitate, educate, inoculate, organize, and then union. Most importantly, and also across industries, is agitating. Typically, it's pretty easy to agitate your coworkers because there's something that you can agree on that you need more of, whether it's money or benefits or scheduling, whatever it may be. It's always good to agitate your coworkers to then give the opportunity later down the road to be able to offer a solution of how you can deal with whatever grievances you all have. The problem with the partner bonding nights was the second one I organized, the boss, who was went to my high school, was a grade younger than me. He's friendly with everybody. He was our peers or whatever. So he came to the second partner bonding night, which makes it very difficult to complain about work if the boss is there. So those got ended. It then became one-on-ones, and then determined based on the one-on-ones that I had with people where their level of involvement might be, where their consciousness is regarding union things in general. It is Michigan, so typically it's considered a union strong state with the UAW and all the struggles that went on in the last century. But a lot of that's been wiped away. We're now a right to work state. Most people, or a lot of people, don't have a relative anymore that was in a union or in the UAW or in the auto factory, or if they were, they're upset by what happened and the decimation of the auto industry in Detroit, and a lot of the blame is put on the unions, even from old union workers. The important part was relationships and the one-on-ones that I built with people, and it wasn't, surprisingly, it wasn't typical necessarily that the younger people were more radical. There was in particular a woman who'd been there 5 years, and when I described that this could be a proactive mechanism we could have to address grievances on the job and address some of the issues like wages and things like that, she was very receptive and very supportive and on board. It was then when the anti-union campaign began that things changed, and it became very polarized within the store. And Starbucks had a little experience from New York and then Chicago and Massachusetts to develop an anti-union campaign, which was very targeted and very aggressive and very calculated all along the way. The other thing that I found out doing the one-on-ones, and then when we developed a demand letter at the store, was that we agreed collectively that things like wages and scheduling and benefits were important. Those are the key demands of the union overall across the nation. But also, most people at my store found that the compensation to coffee farmers was a major issue that they wanted put in the demand letter over and above anything locally that we wanted. I think it was 2005, there was a delegation of IWW members that went to Ethiopia to meet with coffee farmers there, and that was put on YouTube. That was an effective tool that I was able to use at that time for the other coworkers to show that it's not just about us and about what we have going on in this store, but it's bigger than us and the impact that we can have just by stepping out a little bit together can have a global reach. So that was eye-opening. Other successes were there was a lot of media coverage in the 2+ years that I was there. We had a cable access television show. There's a union member that's editor of a labor news that had a circulation of 10,000, mostly trade union people. There was a lot of articles in there. The mainstream press had a lot of articles because there was the issues of, like I said, compensation to coffee farmers and the NLRB charges. There was a host of NLRB charges we started filing. One was right away after the boss came to that partner bonding night. That's against labor law, so that was one of the first charges we filed. But once the charges started coming down, and then especially after we delivered the demand letter, there was a lot of interest because it's considered conservative of West Michigan, Grand Rapids. It was very surprising that it was happening here as opposed to Chicago and New York where it's more expected. And then typically a lot of the red baiting began then as well when they would talk to Starbucks PR people. They would describe it's a minuscule union, it's an anarchist union, they're not legitimate, they're not real. If our workers really wanted to organize, they talk to a legitimate union, all these kinds of things. But like I would always say to my coworkers and people in the public, is that instead of addressing the issues like compensation to coffee farmers or baristas or scheduling, they're bringing up these other issues. Why not address what the core topics are, which they never did. One of the major successes was shortly after the union began in 2004 was a big push to get time and a half on Martin Luther King Day. There was 7 other holidays where they paid time and a half, 4th of July, I think President's Day is even one of them. And so we made it an issue that, you know, if they are this socially responsible company that they claim to be and spend millions of dollars trying to promote, that they would offer all these baristas time and a half on Martin Luther King Day. It took years of organizing. There was petitions, different campaigns that we do on Martin Luther King Day, petitions among baristas, and I believe it was 2010 or 11 maybe that they officially started giving time and a half pay for Martin Luther King Day across for 100,000 baristas. So I always like to point to how small we are and minuscule we are, but we adhere to the tactics of minority unionism. So we don't say that you don't have to have everybody in the shop to push demands or to get gains on the job. And I think we've been able to effectively show that. The other major accomplishment, at least during my term there, was Global Day of Action that was held in July 5th of 2008. We were contacted shortly in the beginning of 2008 by the CNT in Spain. They had a member that worked there in Seville and was fired, and they were interested in organizing with us a Global Day of Action. So we agreed and we started organizing for that. So the IWW branches and then also the affiliates of the International Workers Association. And so in the preparation of organizing for that, I was fired in May, in the middle of May. And the reason they used was for a tardy that was like a 5-minute tardy a month before, prior. So it was obvious that it was because I was an outspoken union member, and we eventually filed charges on that. The NLRB subpoenaed all the records of employees clocking in across the district and found that, you know, it was much rampant, you know, everyone comes in late, and I happened to be late a month earlier and was terminated. So then it became a reinstatement of Monica in Seville, Spain, and me in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And through the coordination, it was actually the largest coordinated action against Starbucks ever to date. There was 20 countries participated, different IWA affiliates and also supporters, 4 continents, you know, over 300 people. So for a company that spends millions of dollars on public relations, it was definitely a big blow to them to have all these people throughout the world saying on the same day, stop firing people for union activity, let people have a union, compensate coffee farmers for these beans, you know, the list of demands that we have. So with that being said, I got 2 minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. Quickly then, the failures, I think, is that the urge of going public, we did too soon. We went public right away. Shortly after the boss, they found out that we were organizing, initiated cameras, and intimidated in other ways, put up postings in the back of the store. We relied too heavily on the NLRB, although it gave us legitimacy to some of the workers that questioned whether we were legitimate or whatever, and seeing that the federal government was taking our cases, they did give us legitimacy. At the same time, we didn't give enough there wasn't solid enough of a core in the committee to withstand, you know, my termination, to keep it going and not be intimidated all the way around. And then I guess I'll just end with, so the results of my case was going to be a trial, the NRB and also OSHA. A week before my termination, I filed on a leaking air conditioner, and then I was fired shortly after that. So OSHA was going to try to get me reinstated, and also the NRB. The day before the trial, Starbucks did a background check and found out that I lied on my application. We tried to get people to work there for a couple years to no avail. So if you did a Google search, at that point Starbucks wasn't doing Google searches of employees, so I didn't think I would get hired if they did a search to see my involvement in the IWW. They didn't do that search, but I did lie on my application. I got out of prison in 2004, so there's 3 years I couldn't account for, and I put that I was in the Peace Corps. I didn't think I'd get the job anyway. It was a last ditch effort to get in, and I got in the day before they found out, and so they call it after acquired evidence. So they say they wouldn't have hired me anyway if they had known that, but they never managed to do a background check until there was going to be a trial for my labor activity. So if you intend on salting or organizing a workplace, keep that in mind, that they will check that shit later. Okay, thank you, guys.
Okay, great. That means we can do Q&A for as long as we need. Does anybody have a question? We don't have much time, but we'll just try to keep it really short and actually have a question, not really just say a statement.
I was wondering if the second speaker, because most of my involvement with the labor movement has been in the Midwest, where United Electrical is, at least in my experience, the stronger union. So I was wondering if they have a presence here, and if you think they're more radical, and if you have more of an inclination towards the IBEW for a specific reason or not?
Yeah, the United Electrical Workers, I don't believe, are here at all, and I don't have any inclination toward either. I've heard great things about what they've done on the other coast, but no, and I don't have any strong inclination toward the IBEW either. I just happen to be a member. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Watson Ladd, a member of the Iowa Civilian Society. I would like to ask the members to sort of try, I think a bunch of you have talked about the relation between needing to politicize members to get them to sort of agree that unions are necessary, that people should be part of a union, and the tension with doing that and not wanting to take over other struggles. How, in a sense, do you want to respond to each other's experiences with that question?
Oh, that's a tough problem.
But everybody's looking at me.
You want to say something?
Sure,
okay.
Sure.
I got something too. Go ahead,
Ed. I'll just try and be really brief. With the poor truckers, I wouldn't. Regarding unions, it was so complicated. The relationship with unions there was so complicated. But at the end of the day, when a mass of workers get together and say, "We want this, and we're going to do this," if we don't get it, you know, whether or not it's legal for them to be in a union or I want them to be in a union, I think that's actually what it is. So I never had to push them towards being in a union, just sometimes I had to convince them that was kind of what they were doing. And I don't have an inclination that they should be in a traditionally structured union. I'm really stoked on people getting together collectively to decide what they want and fight for it. And I don't really care if it's called a union or has bylaws or what. But that's what they were doing already, and so all I was trying to do was to make it like more successful and known about.
Okay, I want to add to that really quickly that I'll sum it up this way. Workers create unions. Unions do not organize workers. It's the other way around. So that's another thing. That's, workers do that naturally, so all we do is kind of facilitate the process and try to push it a little further.
Our moat's all over. We got files.
She's in the back.
For the first speaker, can you say a little bit more about the, you said the end of the struggle is that there was a rightward turn on the truckers?
I don't know how to make that brief, but I think one of the hugest factors in the rightward turn of the truckers had to do with the ILWU not honoring their picket line. I think that was one of the primary factors. It caused a huge amount of tension, and rather than being willing not only to work with the ILWU themselves, it pushed them away from any model remotely resembling what they were doing. It was reactionary. They wanted to separate themselves, and they started to see the ILWU as the enemy because rather than the bosses, because the ILWU they were acting like basically the cops, like they had the power to shut down their picket lines, so they did, and that's what the cops do. And so if the boss is your enemy and the cops are enforcing what the boss does, the cops are the enemy, right? And the ILWU was doing that. So I'm not sure they were wrong about the ILWU being their enemy, but I would say that that is the primary reason that there was a rightward shift in the politics of the truckers. Because there was a time when they went to the ILWU and they asked them for help and they thought that they were getting help. And 100 with 100, yeah, with 100 truckers with matching t-shirts. And they went to ask for help, like, really humbly. And the response that they got was really lukewarm. And it was the beginning of a shift in their politics and also in their trust for collective organizing. Because what they saw was that it was used to hurt people like them.
Somebody else?
Yeah, I had just a question about the ongoing organization. I think the work you guys did, everybody here did, in the heat of the battle is really important, democratizing the struggles and really listening to workers. But when you talk about what you maintain beyond that, I mean, do you have any experiences or any perspectives that you want to share beyond, you know, getting a union there, a particular contract fight, but then what?
That's actually a great question. So I don't think any of us here were involved in contractual fights, but I don't know how important that was to your question. But like with the Whole Foods campaign, it's complicated, but it kind of fizzled out, which was something that we wanted to not only like win material gains and develop revolutionary consciousness, but we also wanted to establish some sort of formation that was kind of semi-permanent, at least, that could carry the struggle forward. And so the cookie crumbled that a lot of the leading people kind of fell off. But at least looking back, I think one of the things that we were able to do that is still useful is to develop people as leaders who had never taken a leadership role in their lives at all. That was very evident. And, you know, they carry that with them and they continue as workers and they know that they're capable of doing those things. So, and that's what's happened historically, I think, is through those experiences that, and that confidence, you kind of carry those forward. And we've seen that historically. So that's my answer to that.
I would just say in the Starbucks experience that it was, although it did, effectively demolish the campaign we had at that location, shortly after that we were contacted by Jimmy John's workers. We started the Jimmy John's campaign there. Shortly after that, there was call center workers. Through the exposure, they came and contacted us. They eventually won a contract. There was an old saying in the IWW I read that it's more important in the victories are the fights themselves, to gain the tools and to be able to go on and fight the fight the next day. I didn't get much time talking about my IBW experience, but I would say is that a lot of times in my experience with coworkers, I'm a journeyman lineman now with Local 1245, is explaining the differences between my experience in the IWW, which is democratic and transparent, as opposed to my experience with the IBW, where meetings are typically just retirees and me, and decisions are decided before we get there. You know, it's always unanimous. You know, there's never any real discussion. You know, all those kinds of things. Tons of people getting lots of high salaries, no democracy. I try to, instill that it could be different and that we decide, because it's our union. I had the benefit of working with some old linemen from Detroit and stuff, and one of the important things I tell all other apprentices and linemen that I work with now is he told me never vote for a contract, ever, no matter what. Because whatever they're offering, we deserve more. And that mentality I try to instill, in a lot of these people I work with now because, they make union scale. So they're typically upset about things like taxes and they're typically racist, xenophobic, homophobic, those types of things. But, if I can be the voice to try to radicalize the people within those positions and say, oh, I'm tired today because I was out in the streets last night fighting the cops over the Mike Brown, Eric Garner decision, that type of thing. I think it's important. I think the task of anarchists at the workplace is not only organized with coworkers for bread and butter issues on the job each day, but also to try to relate it and push our coworkers and our industries into movements towards our class interests, whatever they may be, police brutality. That's why I'm encouraged by the May 1st ILWU labor action that's going to go on against the police brutality that's been going on. So that's all.
Anybody else? Okay, let's give it up for everybody that spoke today. Out. There's another panel that starts at 45 after, and also these people will be around. If you didn't get a chance to ask a question, we'll talk to them more, hit them up. Thanks a lot.
That was really good, guys. Can we get a picture real quick?
You can see you combined the time, the wrong time I said and the right time Robbie said.